Blog Talk Radio.
Patriot Nation Radio Live, 347-637-3942.
That's right, 347-637-3942, 347-637-3942. And we have been getting a lot of callers lately, so it's been awesome. People I have never heard of in places, I have to look up the area codes, but you got to be careful because you never know who's on the other side. They might be harassing you, and that has happened on this network, but not on my show. Everybody's friendly to me. So this is another day on Wednesday, the American Allegiance show, okay, from the Patriot Nation Network. Thank you, everybody at the Patriot Nation Network, for believing in me, for helping me out. And El Guapo, the boss man, lives down in Florida. I'm jealous. Mark, you're awesome. James, congratulations on your new guest you're having coming up. And everybody pay attention. Thursday, James is going to have a really interesting attorney, a historical figure. And on his show, Conservative Perspective, and I believe he's going to rock the red this year. I'm pretty sure. And I'd like to go, but I don't have the time. I'm going to be going out to Seattle for work. So other than that, I'd like to introduce our guest tonight. His name is Robert Redeker. He actually made it to Chief Master Sergeant before he retired. He had a long, distinguished career, and he was also in the Army, which I did not know till today. I thought he was Air Force. I thought he started out as an Army and then got into the Air Force, but he actually started in the Air Force, went to the Army, and then back into the Air Force. So he's going to talk about his experience in Thailand supporting the Vietnam War. So, welcome to the show, Mr. Redeker. Thank you for your service.
Thank you, Kevin. Thank you for having me.
You are welcome, sir. Tell us about your career in the military.
Okay, basically I started 1966, July 25th, 1966. Went to basic training, Amarillo Air Force Base, and after I got out initially active duty, I went to school in Pittsburgh for a couple of years. Then I got my AMP license. Then I joined the Army Guard just for some extra money. And next thing I knew, I was a technician there as a Huey crew chief for 4 years. And then I switched from there. I was able to get a spot back in Toledo, and that's where I finished my career.
Awesome. So you got your AMP license, is that correct?
That's correct, yes.
I did not know that. That's interesting.
Yeah, I worked civilian aviation at Akron Municipal Airport for a while, for a couple of years, before I got back in service with the Army. And like I said, I was a Huey crew chief there. I just loved every bit of it, except it's hard to go from the Air Force to the Army. The other way around is perfect. You know, I'm going, why am I sleeping on the ground, you know? Things like that.
Right. Where's the hotel,
Where's
right?
The
Where's the Wi-Fi?
Yeah. That's it. Where's the Wi-Fi?
Yeah, you know, like I said, thank you for your service. So you somehow you got into the Army. Can you explain how that happened?
Well, basically, like I said, when I got out of active duty with the Air Force after two tours during the Vietnam War, I needed some extra money. Like I said, as an A&P. And for those that don't know what the wage scale was back then, a fixed base operator, I was making $3.25 an hour as a licensed aircraft mechanic. So I joined the 107th Armored Cav Regiment just to make some extra money on the weekends. And within a couple months, I was full time. So that's how I got in the Army side of the house.
Gotcha. So being in that unit, you guys were called up. You just happened to be there. Is that what happened?
No, yeah, we didn't. No, we didn't get called up there, Mike. The only time I was over there was during the Air Force. I was there in Utapao,
gotcha.
Thailand, January 66 to January 67, and again PCS January 69 to January 70. I was there when the first B-52 landed. So it was quite a something to see. Yeah, I was a B-52
yeah.
mechanic and hydraulics and KC-135.
Ah, gotcha. Yeah, those are old airplanes, both of them, and they're both in service today still.
Yeah. Your last week's show, you were talking about that, and I was telling you that the KC-135 was the A model. The B-52 were the tall tail. They were Ds and Fs mostly. There were some Gs during the war, but most of them were flying out of Guam. So we had pretty much just Ds and Fs at Utapao.
Wow. So, okay. So Utapao was an air base? Is that what that was?
Utapao was one of 8 air bases in Thailand. But most people don't realize that 80% of all air campaigns flown over Vietnam were launched in Thailand.
Oh, really?
Yeah,
80%. I have no idea.
Yes. Yeah. Most people don't. It's kind of one of those things they think everything happened within country. Well, like the B-52, for example. First of all, if you put it in Vietnam proper, they'd be blown up every chance they got. And second of all, they could never get off the ground fast enough. So they were they flew from our base and, of course, Guam. But when they opened our base, it could cut the mission time by 2/3 or 3/4 compared to Guam.
Yeah, that's that makes a lot of sense. Next country over, just like we still do today, like we go to Iraq, we're actually another country. Nobody actually flies out of there, of course.
Exactly. Yep. Exactly. Yeah. Same thing. Yeah.
So those are things I don't think about, you know. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It was. Let's see. I got back in. Like I said, it was there. January 67. So 68, and then I got stationed at Castle Air Force Base in California for a year, and then I got PCS orders to go back to Thailand to support the war. So like I said, I spent almost half of my career in Thailand or during the Vietnam War.
That's incredible.
Yeah. And it was a long time ago, but yeah, memories are still fresh as can be. We have an alumni site. And I went to my first reunion just past November, and we're going to have another one this year. It's going to be in Vegas. And actually met up with a couple of people from the hydraulic shop there. That was stationed in 1969, yeah.
Wow, that's awesome.
That's pretty cool. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, that's incredible, you know, that's incredible because, you know, you have something in common. You guys work together and you fought together. And I'm sure it wasn't easy for you guys to do that kind of thing, even though you're not on the ground with the Army. It's just, there's a lot of stress, you know, with that kind of operation.
Operational stress, red balls, you know, you name it. Had to get those birds in the air because they were flying for a reason, whether it be protecting the Army or protecting the Marines, you know, it didn't matter. You know, you had to get them in the air. There was pretty much zero tolerance for failure.
Yes. Yeah, I totally understand that. You have to be successful. That is your mission.
Yes.
So the mission becomes part of your life, and that's your goal.
Yes.
Your goals are all the same.
Yes.
Everybody wants the planes off the ground.
Exactly. Exactly.
So did you have a family at the time when you left, or are you not married or single?
No, I was single until I got out active duty, and I got married when I was going to Pittsburgh Institute of Aeronautics. I got married in, what was that? That was 71, excuse me. I had to think back at 1971 is when I got married, so that's when I joined the Army side after that, but so we could start a family. But you know, no, I was single in Thailand, and it's a good place to be single, not just let it go.
You know, I've heard that so many times from different people.
Yeah.
And I'm starting to find out, a friend of mine who's Filipino, was a Filipino national, now he's an American I work with, who's telling me all kinds of stories. So, a lot of things happen in the Middle East and Southeast Asia, even in the Philippines, I'll just say that. American.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly.
So,
yeah.
So that's interesting. I like, you know, I'm a big hero of Vietnam veterans. I mean, they're my heroes. I'm a big fan of them and what they did and the stuff they put up with. And my dad was in Vietnam as well. They did a lot of things that we would never even think of that weren't in the books, of course. And
exactly.
I remember there's a lot of things that happened. My uncle was in there. He got a Purple Heart. He was in the Army at the time. And they just, I mean, it's the conditions they had to live through in the jungle and everything and the missions you had. And it was a very unpopular war. And
very.
The hippies were after you guys. it was like an avalanche when you got home. And it was a shame, you know, that was going on. I mean, they could have been recruited. I'm sure you'd seen a lot of people there who probably should not have been in the Army or should never have been recruited. If, you know, what do you call it?
Put
into service. Yes.
Yeah.
Put into service, drafted against their will. I'm sure that's chaos because we like volunteer soldiers and airmen and seamen and Marines. That's what we like because they got to want to be there to make it work. So do you have any stories or anything you can tell us about how that affected your missions?
Oh yeah. Like I say, first of all, we were drafted and Air Force was the only service, even during Vietnam War, that didn't draft people. They had enough volunteers.
Really?
Yes, they were the only service that did not draft anybody. They had enough volunteers to come in. Now, what hurt was where they put them. Like you said, you know, there's some people there that should not have been in positions that they were. But then again, you know, that's what happened. So you just make the best of it. Now, coming back home the first time, that was January 68, it was kind of an eye-opener. You knew before you left what might be waiting for you. Before I went into service, I went to Kent State University for a year, and I was in Air Force ROTC. And this was in 65, 66. And even that early, when we had our formations, we were surrounded by anti-war students, you know, so I already had a feeling before I went in of what it was going to be like. But when he came home, we landed at Travis Air Force Base, and from there you took a taxi or a shuttle to San Francisco airport. Well, when you got in there, you were greeted by all sorts of different people, and you had to be in uniform back then to get the deal to fly where you're going home. It was, if you're in uniform, if you wanted to go on standby, it was half price ticket. If you wanted to get a guaranteed seat, it was, I think, three-quarter price ticket. So you had to be in uniform to get your tickets. So but what happened when the taxi or the shuttle let you off, you're greeted by people that did not care that you were in the Vietnam War. You were pretty much verbalized everything that, you know, from baby killer to warmonger to everything, even though, you know, you volunteered to do it, you came home and you felt it hurt you. I mean, you know, that's the best way to put it because it still bothers me on some of it, you know. So you had people calling you everything, and not just the so-called hippies. I mean, it was people in the airport didn't want anything to do with you. You know, this is just a weird situation. You know, something that today's troops, thankful, don't have to go through it. They don't blame the troops for what's going on. You know, it's more towards the government. So it was kind of an eye-opener. You were met at the airport, like I say, and they were kind of lined up at you. Not everyone got spit on, but a lot of people got spit on. A lot of people had stuff, liquids thrown at them. I wasn't there, but I had a friend who said it smelled like urine to him. You know, I can't verify, but I trust him. And it was just, it was weird coming back to the world, as they called it, be treated like that.
So you probably thought that, hey, they're going to treat us like heroes and we're going to be treated nicely. I'm sure that was in your mind, unless you knew about things before you went there.
Right. Yeah, that was in my mind, except for my ROTC a little bit that I had that 1 year. It kind of had an idea of what was going on. Plus, you read in the papers, you know. You knew what the climate was there. And it was now – the Freedom Bird coming home, you couldn't say enough about the flight attendants. You know, they were just spectacular. But once you got into the airport, it was quite different. I'm going to digress a little bit. When I got out of basic training, I was at Amarillo Air Force Base. It was during an airline strike. And we took a train from Amarillo Air Force Base to Chanute Air Force Base in Illinois. Anyway, we got in. It was about 10 o'clock. We got on the train, and we got sleeping berth. He said, well, this is going to be good. Well, about 5:36 in the morning, I don't remember exact time, they pounded on the door and said, grab your stuff. It's time for breakfast. We want you to eat before the people eat. And I'm going, aren't I a people? But that was not just on the train. We weren't even overseas yet, you know. Just show you the climate, the people, how they felt, you know. It was different back then.
Right. Can't imagine.
Yeah. It's, and then... go ahead.
Oh, no, you go ahead.
No, that's fine. I was just going to say, then, you know, in between my PCS, I was stationed in California, and we used to go once a month to San Francisco in the height of the, you know, the hippie movement, and it was like a zoo effect. We would look at them, and they would look at us, you know. It was a,
wow.
I don't have any, that's the way I call it, zoo effect, because we're just staring at each other, you know.
Whoa.
But, yeah, but they actually, once you got in the middle of them, they didn't treat you that bad. It was more, you know, more at the airports and trains, like I said earlier and stuff. It was quite different. It was quite different. Now, coming home the second time wasn't any better. And you couldn't hide the fact I came at BCS every January. Here I was with a tan and, you know, a burr haircut. You could not hide it, even when you're in civilian, you know.
Right.
Yeah, there was no way you could hide it. But it was surprising how many people, and not just the so-called hippies, disrespected the military at that time.
Incredible.
It was something to think about. Now, we'll go back to the Army when I was with the 107th Armored Cav out of Akron Canton Airport. We had a centennial parade in October of 77. We were marching down Euclid Avenue in downtown Cleveland. Students from Cleveland State University were throwing eggs at us.
Wow.
And this was 1977, 2 years after everything stopped, you know.
Right.
So they didn't hit us. They were too far away, but the intent was there. You know, they were throwing eggs at you. Just, you know, I'm going, really? But, yeah, that's the way it was.
That's awful.
Yeah.
That's
yeah. Go ahead.
No, it's That's 77. That's crazy.
That
you know, I didn't think things went. Wow.
Yeah.
I was
dependent. 77.
Wow.
Yeah.
I have no idea.
Yeah.
Well,
and
you know, oh, go ahead.
No, that's right. Go ahead.
I have a friend. His name is Wayne Smith. He lives down in Florida. They just named a street after him. He was a Vietnam pilot, F-4 pilot. He got shot down after 97 missions. He was in the Hanoi Hilton, and they came back on the 141 that's in the museum right now. And
right.
I need to have a show with you guys, all the Vietnam guys on heroes. That would be interesting. But
he was he definitely was going through more than I ever experienced.
Everybody who went there and came back, I applaud them. It doesn't matter what you did over there; you were part of the team. Everybody, it takes mechanics to get the pilots in the, you know, in the air, and it takes everybody to make the whole war work. But it's incredible because you know. I was a dependent in the Philippines at the time when you were back in 77. And it's hard to imagine that because it's a very patriotic community, right? And
yes,
in the Air Force. And I never knew it was like that. I never saw that myself. But then again, Vietnam was the poison. It was a deadly blow to the military and to our country. So you identify with that. I can't. I don't. My dad went through. I don't remember, it's appalling, really. And then I went on a rant last week because I was talking about even these heroes, and you can't even get your VA. Which do you? You go to the VA office and they fight against you. It's ridiculous.
Yeah.
You serve your country. You deserve what you deserve. So even if it's in your records, it's rigged against you, and you have to get an attorney or have one appointed to you to make it any headway. And I think that's a crime right there. And nobody's taking care of it. But we'll take care of our senators and congressmen and everybody else and the corporations and whoever, but we don't take care of our vets like we should. And I wish you the best on that end of it. I know you're going through that right now.
Yes.
So you have to be smarter. The average person's not going to get anything. That's the sad thing, or very little. So, just relates back to we need to respect our veterans. I mean, without them, we would be another country.
Yep, you're right. Well, you know, talk about the respect, and you talk about Congress. Agent Orange is a big thing from the military.
Yes.
They have what's called, in Vietnam, it's called boots on the ground. It doesn't matter where you were, how you got it, if it's exposed or not, you're eligible for Agent Orange benefits. Thailand, like I say, 50,000 troops, 8 bases. You have to prove to get anything, and then you're probably going to have to hire a lawyer. There's a gentleman from my alumni site right now that has filed 7 times for Agent Orange benefits, and he's not getting anything. He wound up hiring a lawyer. Vietnam vets are trying to get Congress to pass a bill also that's called Boots on the Ground, so you don't have to go through this. But that's where we're at with that. Talk about disrespect. It's still being disrespected, you know, to this day. Congress is not helping out. When I went through to Pal Thailand, the base was only 6 months old. We lived in tents, which eventually became hooches, and eventually they built barracks. But they had to clear the whole base out, and guess what they used? Agent Orange and other herbicides.
No.
But
no way.
But you got to prove that. Yeah. Now you have to prove it. The only ones that can get it right now with the least amount are the security forces that were on the perimeter. But guess how we got from the tanker side to the B-52 side? We followed the perimeter road right past the guard shacks, you know, that are authorized to get it. You know, it makes no sense. But, you know, so we're still getting disrespected, as far as I'm concerned, by our own government and the VA.
I agree, because we have money for everything but that. You know, we have money for Kiev and Afghanistan. How much money do we sink in these other countries? And we are, like, not even looking at what we have, what we owe our own people, our heroes that made us what we are today. That's a shame. I don't know who it's like. Okay, here's the point. They don't care. I just don't care about the veterans. I think that's the case. It's got to be. There's no other explanation. Yeah. It's been years and decades. Something should have been done by now. I know President Trump tried to get things done, but it's a monster organization. They don't know one end to the other. Right.
Nope. Well, like I told you before the broadcast, you know, I've been trying to get my VA benefits for something that happened to me in 1970. I could not get anyone in the VA to even find me until we moved here where we live now in Tennessee. It only took the VSO about 10 minutes to find me in the system. But no one else from all that time could help me, you know. So, you know, at least, like I said earlier, I'm in the system now, or trying to be in the system, you know. But like I say, this is started back in 1970 for me.
That's a long, long time. So if you do, if that stands, then you're going to get that back day on that, if they have a record of it somewhere. But
they have a record But like I say, the pay now, there's a disconnect that they're trying to fix. It's when you first established your VA account, as opposed to when they first ran your stuff. I mean, basically saying that once I filed, they're trying to get the money, so that'd be back in 1970. But the way the system is now, it's when the system finally got me going is when I'll get to pay for, you know.
Yeah, unnecessary.
Okay,
as a mechanic, did you fly on any missions, or was it just strictly for crews?
There were a couple of guys in the hydraulic shop that I didn't find out till later. On their days off, they flew with the Young Tiger with the tanker missions. Just the go and watch, but no, I never got to fly. And closest I ever came was an electrician and I were in the tail section of a B-52, and it taxied while we were still working on it. What really kind of scared me was we knew what runway they were taking off and what direction, you know. And all of a sudden, we're just chugging down the road, bouncing in the back, and I'm going, uh-oh, something ain't right. Well, what happened? They changed the direction of the runway. All of a sudden, we stopped. The tail gunner threw his headset to us from underneath the horizontal stabilizer. We told the pilot what's going on, and he said, I'll take it. They opened up the hatch, had a ladder. We jumped out. We're on the active runway.
Whoa.
And they took up the, so that was pretty close to going with them on it, because he kept saying, electrician, I kept saying, do they remember we're still back here? You know? So,
whoa.
Yeah.
And that was an active runway. I was going to say, the scariest place in the world is an active runway. You don't want to be on it ever, because it's completely traffic-filled nightmare disaster, and you got to find your way to get off. I can't even imagine doing that. So how'd you get off?
Well, they just opened the hatch. It's called the 47 section. They had a ladder there. They grabbed us, grabbed on that ladder, and before they even got the ladder underground, he pulled full power and took off.
Whoa, that's crazy.
Yeah, yes. Things were a little different then. You'd have a red ball on something, and you'd fix it enough to get the airplane up. Crew chief
right.
would write it on a diagonal while the airplane flew. Really? As soon as it landed, it went on a red X, you know. It's stuff
wow.
you would never do normally, but, you know, mission, you know, there were people like Quezon. We've gotten quite a few accolades from the Marines of Quezon for what we did, you know, over there. And, you know, you just didn't stop a mission. I've had a pilot take off with two brakes I had to cap off. And he took it.
Really?
Because he knew what
war,
the important
wartime.
Was, you know. Yep, wartime.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. Thailand was we weren't considered in the combat zone, even though some of the bases did get hit, but we were considered in the war zone. So, but we didn't get the combat pay because of our location, but, you know, but they were called the communist terrorists or CTs that, you know, tried to infiltrate the bases. And a couple of bases got hit pretty hard. So one of the eight bases was called Nam Kham Phnom or NKP. And it sat on the Mekong River on the Laotian border. And that's where they flew all the rescue missions out of for downed pilots. You know, so, you know, a lot went on in Thailand that most people don't realize.
Wow. So I've heard of the NKP before. Very interesting.
Yeah.
Everything's fitting together now. So even though you didn't get hit or anything, but you're still in the arena, you know what I mean? You guys are still doing the missions out of there. It doesn't really matter. You guys are part of the missions. You make it happen.
Yeah.
So you're still, I mean, that's how the Air Force does combat.
Yeah. Yeah. It's different than the other, you know, we stand by and say, go get them, you know, and let the pilots go after them. So,
right.
Yeah, we had one guy tried to bust through the security on a moped. He had a backpack on of some sort, you know, I don't know what it was, satchel charge, whether he's on tanker side. He didn't make it very far. They stopped him, so to speak. Yeah.
So it was real life airfield intrusion then.
It really was.
Yeah, they do the exercises today still. They put random people nobody knows. They'll throw them on the flight line, and then we'll have to tackle them, you know, stop work and get rid of the guy. And, I'm glad they're still practicing that.
Yeah, back when I after I came back my second tour, I was stationed at Warner Robins, Georgia. And, of course, SAC had alert missions. And they used to go around to the young kids and say, hey, we'll give you a day off if you try to infiltrate the alert pad. Of course, the alert pad was loaded with nuclear munitions, you know. And most of these kids only did it once. Only did it once because the security police would pretty much tell them you're not wanted, you know.
Right. Yeah. Wow. I've seen guys get tackled pretty hard. So the crew chiefs don't play.
Yeah. No. And just think if you're trying to go on where they got nukes loaded.
Yes. Right.
Well, I had a...
That's the other
factor. Security police. Yeah, I had a security police put an M16 to the back of my head one time.
Really?
I was on the alert pad. Yeah, everything's a two-man policy. Well, the tanker we were working on at that time was almost straight across from the alert facility, the building itself. Well, there was myself and another hydraulic man, and of course, a crew chief and one of the pilots or co-pilots or whatever, you know. So you had a two-man policy. Well, I was up in the cockpit running the spoilers, and I came down the ladder on a tanker, which you know about. I got about two rungs from the bottom, and someone grabbed me by the scruff of my neck and threw me flat. Face first into the concrete and put an M16 to my head. And I'm going, because I still feel it now as we're talking. I still get chills.
What happened was
the crew decided to go get a coffee. Since we were so close to the jet. Well, guess what? If they wrote us up, they'd have to write the crew up too. So everything got smoothed over by the officers, but you know, but I still remember that to this day. I still can feel that right on the back of my neck.
So they thought you were
thinking about it. Yeah.
Wow.
They didn't know. My other buddy was working on the wing on the other side. They didn't see him, you know, so I was the only one they saw coming down the ladder.
So they didn't check your badge or anything? They just did it?
But after I wiped up the puddle that I was laying in after they threw me on the ground, yeah. But
wow.
Yeah, but again, it was the fact that there was no one else with us. We were doing
right.
The two man, but the air crew went decided to get a coffee because we can see the airplane from here. Well, that wasn't good enough.
Right. Yeah, they're pretty serious about that.
Yeah, they are. Now, coming back, I got to tell you how people in the United States really need to go see what the rest of the world looks like and feels like. You've been TDY enough to know that you never badmouth America again after you see some of the stuff that other countries, you know,
yeah.
How they, absolutely. Second trip, we were sitting at the Bangkok airport waiting for our flight to come in, and I saw this local walking up and down just like casing, and he grabbed someone's gym bag at the time. Well, he grabbed it and took off, and I yelled. People got up. This was the middle of the night. Ran after him.
What?
So, yeah, that's exactly what happened. I don't know.
They shot him.
If he lived, died. They shot him first and asked me what happened. Why I was yelling thief. Yeah.
Yeah, they do
that
kind of things in other countries.
Yeah.
They don't hesitate in some countries. I mean, they don't care about life.
No.
Life.
No. No, they don't. Their life is cheap. I had one day, we were going to town, and we were in they called it a baht bus. A baht was the currency in Thailand. And we were going to town, and we were complaining about something happened at the base. And the driver turned around and said, "You want your shop chief killed?" And he goes, "No." I said, "Two cartons of Salem cigarettes." I said, no, we're just complaining. We don't want him killed, but that's exactly how things were. The king and queen of Thailand smoked Salems, not their own brand. So it was prestigious to have Salem cigarettes, believe it or not.
Wow.
Yeah.
Whoa. Wow.
Yeah.
That's incredible.
It is,
yeah.
Long time ago. So,
yeah, that's something else, you know. And like I said, I lived in a foreign country for 3 years, and you heard about stuff like that. They would be harsh on the soldiers. I mean, it's just people have no idea what it's like. Turkish people do the same thing in other countries. I mean, death is nothing. It's like, oh, he fell asleep, kill him. And that's how your life
you're
is.
You're right, yeah. Yeah. Luckily,
so appreciate what we have.
People didn't do that. Yeah. Appreciate what we have. Exactly. Bottom line, you don't know what you have until you see others. You know? So, yeah, life is a lot cheaper over there.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a whole other paradigm. You know, things we never think about. Like we're over in Africa and the orphan kids are smoking cigarettes. You know, and they treated them like dirt.
Yeah.
I mean, they steal their toys and they run off with them, and they thought it was funny.
Yeah.
And because, you know, some people are considered outcasts. People we care for are outcasts other places. So they admire the older people, but if you're an outcast and you don't have a family, then you're nobody. You're nothing.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. But one thing that the rest of the world does that we don't do good enough, as far as I'm concerned, is they honor their older people. You're just talking about
that.
They honor the seniors of the family, you know, and the elders of the family. And here, we're just another old person, you know, sometimes.
Yep, we got to put them away, put them in the home, or you know, that's the attitude.
Yeah.
But I always admire older people. I admire them. And, you know, the African culture is actually they have a name for older people. It's called Mzee. Mzee is your title, and it's most respected of all titles in that part of the world, because they do admire and they respect, just like in Southeast Asia and other parts of the world. They are mm-hmm. the authorities, and they are the most wise. But somehow we got away from that here.
Yeah. So, well, the Indian culture, the Native American culture, was that way here, you know, in America at one time.
Yes. Right.
Yeah.
That is true.
Yeah. Yeah. So yeah, somehow we got away from that. But anyways. You bring back a lot of memories there, Kevin. I haven't thought a lot of this stuff in a long, long time.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate you sharing it with us. Did you eat any food, native food there while you were there? Is that something you guys did or could you?
Yeah. Yeah, I ate, there were a lot of local restaurants. I learned, believe it or not, of course, this was in January 67. At that point, I never ate Mexican food. And this is local
really?
Food, but never ate Mexican food. We went out to eat that night in Bangkok. That's the first time I ever ate Mexican food was in Bangkok. But the locals,
really?
They had their restaurants. You go out there and ate a lot of fried rice, you know, fried rice and, you know, it was if chicken fried rice was my main dish. But yeah,
okay.
We all ate at local restaurants. Everyone ate at the local restaurant, you know. And it wasn't hot as you think it is now. Of course, you could get the spice if you wanted it, but, you know. But it was good. Local food was actually quite good. Yeah. The only thing that I could not eat for maybe 15 years after I left was tapioca. Right outside our main gate was a tapioca farm. And they used human waste as fertilizer.
Oh, no, they didn't. No, no.
Yes, they did. And the smell, I mean, I couldn't eat tapioca.
I can imagine.
Yeah. Yeah, strange things are popping in my head here, yeah. But, yeah, it was.
Sorry.
But eating local was good. Eating local was good. Your burgers, their hamburgers are basically, their beef came from mostly water buffalo type animal, you know. So it was different flavor, different texture, but it's still, you know, they tried to cater to the GI as much as they could to make it like was in, you know, the United States.
Oh,
but,
that's fascinating.
Yeah, it was good. Yeah, I only ate one dish one time that they were laughing at me when I was eating it, and it had dog in it. I did not know that.
Oh.
And they're all laughing, and they said, yeah, they normally don't eat dog over there, but somehow they did on this one. And they're laughing at me, and they asked me if I wanted it again, more, and I had two options, either get sick or say, yeah. So I said, yeah, I didn't get any more, you know, but they just wanted to see my reaction. But that was the only time I ate anything weird, except now I didn't eat them. Over there they have I don't know if you ever heard of a rice bug. They're a big beetle.
Yeah.
I mean, they're huge.
Uh-huh.
Okay. Well, you used to, on the flight line, if you caught them, they used to pay a nickel a rice bug. And what the locals did is they'd break them open and suck out the insides. It was like a sweet pudding, you know?
Right.
Yeah. So that was something local I did not do.
they did that in the Philippines, too.
Yeah, I'm sure they did, yeah.
No.
Yeah.
Not me.
No. Not me either, yeah, so. But, life was different. Life was different over there. Like I said, we started in the tent when the base first opened. Orly room was in the tent. All we had was the tankers. And then I went to Okinawa TDY for a fan school. And when I got back, it was about a month when we got our first B-52, and what they did is they flew from Guam, dropped their load, landed back at Utapau, got reloaded, went on the next mission, and then flew back to Guam till we were able to get our base set up for them, you know. And there's nothing like watching a 15, 18, 21 B-52s take off in a row.
Yeah.
You know, it's just, they did it in flights of three, groups of three, because of the air turbulence. But now, linebacker two, I wasn't there at part of it, but I knew people who were. In Guam, at one mission, they launched 100 B-52s during linebacker two.
Wow, that's incredible.
Yeah, it is incredible, yeah. And now I think in our inventory we have maybe 78 or 77 B-52s total. You know, but like I said,
yeah,
they're 60 years old. So, but they're getting re-engined, Rolls-Royce engines on them.
Nice.
They just awarded a contract to get new engines, yeah.
And you got to imagine how many bombers they made after the B-52 that are not around anymore.
Oh, yeah. Well, they're already sending some B-1s to the boneyard.
Yeah, they made the B-58 and all these other bombers, and nothing to compare to this B-52 and the range and everything. And you don't have to have speed. I mean, I think that's one of the mistakes they made with the newer bombers. It's not about speed.
Mm-hmm.
It's about ability, and it's about payload.
Right.
So, even the B-2, the brand new one, I mean, it's got technology and everything and stealth capabilities, but I don't imagine the payload. It's hard to tell. You'll never see that anyway.
No.
But they're big on them, though.
Yeah, they are. Yeah, they're already coming out with the B-21? Is that what it is?
Yeah,
I think
that's right.
It looks a lot like the original, you know, what the B-1 or B-2 is now. But the B-58, it ran out of its usefulness because it was strictly for nukes. And it was speed, exactly what you're talking about. The idea was to get in and get out as fast as possible. You know, but it ran out of its usefulness when, you know, we started discontinuing all the nukes we had in the strategic arms limitation talks, you know. We dropped it. And,
right.
Have you ever been out to the boneyard? Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Salt. Even, okay. You know, it still hurts me whenever I see a B-52 cut up. And you know what? They have to keep them in place. I think it's 2 days or 3 days after they guillotine them, for the Russian satellite to go over and verify that it was chopped up.
Yeah, I saw that. That was on my last tour. I actually had a school in the boneyard. We were doing ABDR, putting holes in A7.
That's right, mine also.
Yeah, that was the best trip ever, the best class I ever took. But I got inside of B-52. We got to tour it. Yeah, it's awesome. Awesome aircraft.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. And, of course, now the gunner sits up front on the H models that they got left. But back then, you know, the gunner sat all by himself on the end. And there is actually a gunner in Vietnam War that has a MIG kill.
Really?
Yeah, there's one MIG kill from a tail gunner of a B-52.
Was that a MiG-15?
I really don't remember what it was, but that was pretty awesome, I thought.
Well, that is awesome.
Trying to sneak up on us, you know, considering, yeah.
That is pretty awesome.
Yeah. Now, the during linebacker two, from everything I read and everything I've been told by people at a reunion, you know, military reunion that were there, they said that the North Vietnamese were pretty much out of missiles. If we could have gone and bombed another 3 or 4 days, the war would have been over. But then they stopped us for the talks, you know. And every time they stopped us from bombing, all they did is North Vietnamese was regroup, you know. So, but there was a way to end the war, and it was stopped by the politicians.
Yeah. Let the military do their own thing. Politicians need to stay out.
And I understand the checks and balances, but, you know, while I was there, our missions were dictated pretty much by Lyndon Johnson. He had actually like a chessboard on his table where he moved things around and decided who, what, and where, you know. But, You know, so, you know, it, that's not a way to run a war, and you know that from experience.
Right. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay, yeah, LBJ, yeah, okay.
Yeah.
That doesn't sound good at all.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a lot of things going on over there, but, yeah.
But, like, on the flip side, back here, it was like, you know, this was the British, you know, invasion and free love and hippies and things like that. And so it was a revolution. I mean, I can't believe it came out of WW2 parents. This is what gets me. So something happened along the way there. It's only 20 years later from the end of WW2, and we're into Vietnam, and the public goes crazy. So I can't figure that out. You know, I don't know what happened then. Maybe somebody else does talk about it, but the greatest generation.
They were the same baby, they were the same baby boomers that I am, you know. Like I said, 20 years later. Yeah. But, well, like I say, you know, I told you we'd go to Frisco, and it was, I'd say maybe 10% of all the hippies actually believed in what they were doing. You know, this is just my opinion. Majority of them just used it as a way to drop out of society.
Right, right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think I'm going to look into that, see what I can find, because I'm sure there's something that happened in that meantime, but maybe it was the drugs, maybe it was the music. I don't know what it was, but I can imagine that transformation goes from that to that, because, I mean, people admired, you know, the people in WW2 and a lot of fascinating things. I loved history of that war because there's so many things I had no idea what was going on. Like, every Navy ship had its own orchestra and director on it, on the big ships. I had no idea. James Bostic had that on one of his programs, and they were actually interviewing way back one of the conductors who got off the boat.
Gotcha.
It was on the Pearl Harbor. And they all had their own orchestras. And the Air Force had all kinds of other programs. They had religious programs, spiritual things, you know, they had for the troops.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know about that either. And it's incredible the history we have.
Yeah.
So we know, they teach you all the history and strategies and the people, but there's a lot of other things that they don't tell you about, which you figure out on your own, and the old timers will tell you.
Yeah. Last summer, I was going through some physical therapy, and I was sitting in the waiting room, and I had my Air Force retired hat on. A gentleman came in, an old gentleman, looked at me, put his hand out and shook it, and he pointed his hat. World War II, Battle of the Bulge Survivor.
No way. Wow.
Yeah. So we got talking. That's while he was talking, he told me what unit he was in and everything. And so I looked it up on my phone when we were talking, and the unit that he was in 70 days, lost 5,700 troops.
Incredible.
Yeah, 5,700 troops in just 70 days, and he made it out.
Well,
so, yeah, but those are the heroes.
Yeah, you know, and everybody says, you know, they are the greatest generation and all that, but I think every generation is like that. Everybody that does that. The difference is they just went ahead and did it. They knew they were going to get killed. You know, they got off the boat or whatever. The chances are you weren't going to live, but they went ahead and did it anyway.
Yeah.
Then 20 years later, protesting the war.
Yeah.
So
that's a good point. You're right. What changed? What clicked? Yeah. Yeah. Well, like Kent State, May 4th, that's coming up. Yeah, Kent State.
Would you like to talk about that?
You know.
Would you like to talk about that?
Well, there isn't too much to talk about other than, like I say, it was back in 65, 66, it was already starting to materialized at Kent State. And, you know, within 4 years later, they had the the riot going on there by, it was Governor Rhodes. I know you weren't around there, but Governor Rhodes called the guard up, and a lot of them were students, which really made it hard. But a lot of them were students, and they weren't trained. They were not trained for riot control. You know, that wasn't their job. It should have been the Highway Patrol and other divisions, but they put them in a position that, to this day, I don't think anyone knows who fired the first shot that caused it to escalate.
Yeah. You know more than most of us do. I'm just giving a hint.
Yeah. It was different. Well, Kent State, I didn't realize at the time how liberal Kent State was. You know, so it really is a liberal school, and it showed. But, you know, again, May 4th Coalition, I wasn't there. I was in Georgia at the time. But, you know, some of those people were outsiders. They got things going. I don't know if you knew that.
No.
There's a picture that was in Life magazine or Time magazine of a girl laying over the body. She was like 17 or 18-year-old runaway from Florida, and all she did is go around to different campuses with these group of people to try and get the agitation going on.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah. Wow. That's news to me.
Yeah. When we were flying with the 107th out of Akron Airport on May 4th, it was a no-fly zone at Kent State University. So.
Whoa.
Things were different back then, Kevin.
Yeah, that's Akron Canton area, Akron, I guess.
Yeah, Akron Canton Airport. Yeah. That's where the one.
Hey, guess what's over there?
What?
My wife and I were in that area a few months ago for a wedding, and we went by the Ernest Angley Chapel, by the way.
Yes. Yeah, that's a big giant in Cuyahoga Falls.
Yes. Very interesting part of Ohio. It was blizzarding up there, and it wasn't here.
That's true. Yeah.
And Ken Akron, we have a CAC, they call it. We have a base when I worked at American Airlines. I used to visit there and for maintenance stuff. So very interesting.
You know,
a lot of history up there.
It was. Like I say, that's where the 180th got started. But the hangar was exactly the same hangar we had at Toledo. But they turned it into a museum once the Army moved out to a different facility. And they got a F-16 there with Sonnenberg's name on it, if you ever get up that way. They have a whole tribute to him. Yeah, they have a tribute to Sonnenberg at the little museum they got there.
Oh, okay. Yeah, the pilot I had on a couple weeks ago, Brad Glantz, he was the lead pilot when he was shot down, or his plane malfunctioned or whatever happened to him.
Oh, gotcha. Right. Yeah.
So, I knew him. I knew Kevin. Kevin was a good guy.
I knew him too.
Great guy. One of the greatest pilots.
I knew him before I got out.
That
was quite a shock. But like I say, the I think it's called MAPS or something like it, military. I don't quote me on it, but it's a museum in the hangar, and one of the airplanes is painted with his name on it, F-16.
I saw the pictures of that. I'm going to have to look into that. I would love to go visit that place in honor of him.
Yeah. A lot of history there in that end of the country, like you say.
Yes, a lot. And same thing, I mean, if you ever get a chance to come to Wright-Patterson, to the museum, it is gigantic now.
Yeah.
They've added on a couple of wings probably since you've been there.
Yeah, I haven't been there in, that's probably been 15 years or more.
So they have a Vietnam section just for those aircraft.
Oh, wow.
And they have a B-52 inside, and it's incredible. They got planes, huge planes hanging from the ceiling.
Yeah,
and,
wow. I knew they had a telltale B-52 there, yeah.
Yes. Yes, and you get to see the Global Hawk, the spy plane, how huge. This thing is gigantic. I had no idea until I saw it.
Oh, wow.
That's crazy. So they have an electric F-16 in there, which I worked on once. That shows how old I am. And they have A7. I think there's two F-16s and an A7 and all kinds of other. Everything you can imagine is in there. They keep expanding, and they have, like, even missiles and things like that in there. But it's actually,
cool.
If you ever decide to come up and visit, that would be awesome. I'll take time off. We go there and see it.
Well, that'd be cool. Yeah, I'll let you know. Now, my alumni that I'm with from my base in Thailand was 3 years ago. They had their reunion right there in Dayton, and they all went to the museum. So, yeah, I didn't know about it at the time. I just happened to find them online, and went to my first reunion just last November. It was in Destin, Florida, and this year it's going to be in Las Vegas. But they all, and you're between that one. I think they had one in D.C. So, you know, they always, this group from the war, from Vietnam War, goes to all these different places that have some history in them, you know.
So what is the name of the organization you're talking about?
It's called the Utapau Alumni. It's a closed site, but it's you got Utapau Alumni and Utapau Reunion, two sites online.
Gotcha.
But most of the bases in Thailand have their own too. So, yeah, but like I say,
that's
there
incredible.
Eight bases, 50,000 troops, not counting army. And there were a lot of army there too. We get the bombs coming into our base, the Army took control of all the bombs because they were a transportation company. So they're the ones that actually controlled the delivery of the bombs from the boat to the base, you know. So.
Yeah, I got to love the Army guys. They get it done.
Yep.
They do stuff.
Yep.
And they're out there doing the – I mean, I can't even imagine that kind of life in combat. I can't. I mean, that's a job. I almost joined the Army Guard, but I didn't. I love aircraft, so I went Air Guard.
Yeah, that's, you know, I with being an Air Force RTC, I was going to go Air Force pretty much all the way, you know, so, and I'm glad I did. I had a good career, like we talked earlier. I was my last deployment, I was going to pick for the presidential wing in Washington, D.C. I turned it down, but it was an honor just to be selected.
Nice.
So, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, we have Matt Wright-Patterson, the presidential aircraft office is there. I know people that are in it. It's pretty cool.
Oh, wow. So yeah, it is cool. Yeah.
You have to be an elite guy to get into that. That program. So a lot of former military guys I know are working in there. So all the program offices are there, and the thing is, it's invisible to most people. You know, nobody knows they're there. That's in the Air Force. It's kind of funny that they make sure things happen. It's a weird thing. Your B-52 experience. That is an incredible aircraft. I'm going to say the KC-135 is too. That plane is at the peak of perfection right now, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
All the bugs are out of it, and it's running. And that's what happens. I mean, I like that because I was talking about the Dutch aircraft on the one program versus the American aircraft, and you can tell the difference. It's hard to say. They're like kids to you, and you make sure the kids are taken care of. And it's not like that everywhere. It's not like that. And we were hungry with the MiG-29s. It wasn't like that there. Other countries, the French, the British, nobody's like the U.S., like I was saying before. Mm-hmm. And your planes become a part of your family, of your – they mean something. The tail numbers mean something to you. They have their own personalities, and you get to know them. It's kind of weird if you think about it, but that's just the way it is. And you get to know them.
Now,
that is why.
Yeah. Yeah, in a lot of countries, are in awe of the fact that in the Air Force and all the other services, that a young person, maybe two stripers, three stripers, can be working on an airplane by himself, you know,
yeah.
Where a lot of countries don't do that, you know.
Absolutely.
It's, yeah.
So a little side question for you, your AMP, did that help you in your career? I'm sure, I'm assuming. You know.
I'm not sure if it did or not. Like I say, I was working at my AMP, and when I decided to go to the Army side, I had no helicopter experience. And 3 months after I joined, just as a weekender, I got full-time job there, and I'm actually thinking it had a lot to do with the fact that I did have my AMP.
Yeah.
And then as I progressed, you know, I got to understand, you know, I knew more about different systems other than just one, you know, so on and so forth. Well, a good example, when we were in Panama, we had a bird strike on one of the A-7s right on the leading edge of the intake, and they didn't have any sheet metal people there. So it was Jeff Roy and I were the ones that repaired it to get it home. You know, so I can say my experience that way helped, you know, because I kind of knew what I was doing.
right. You had a clue.
Yeah.
You're educated to do that kind of task, and that's important.
Right.
So,
yes.
I mean, you're always ready. And we had AMPs. I had AMPs that worked for me, you know, as guardsmen, and their knowledge came in handy. And I worked for the airlines that didn't have an AMP, but I understood aircraft. So there was a trade-off.
Right.
And all airplanes are the same, generally. They're all the same. They have the same systems in it. The technology only goes so far.
Mm-hmm.
Until you get to the super stealthy, you know, advanced aircraft, everything's
yeah.
A fighter is the same as an airliner. It's just different shapes.
Yeah. Oh,
and
yeah.
Missions.
It's just different shape, a little bigger. Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
And
because it's still
there are things that I knew was
like all the same systems, yeah.
Yes, and there's a lot of things you know about airlines. You can easily pick that up from your schooling,
mm-hmm.
and even just from working as a hydraulic guy. So
right.
So you're priming yourself for a future, a career when you do that kind of stuff, and they're tangible when you get out. And there's a lot of people that were in the military that now you can go to a 2-week school and get your AMP, pretty much take the test.
Right.
If you're a prior service
yeah.
crew chief or something. So
yeah.
a lot of opportunities out there. For young people,
yeah.
and it's an exciting world.
Yeah, I went through the 2-year course. So, yeah, I went through the 2-year
yeah.
course because, yeah, I wanted to make sure I knew it. I just didn't want to test and then get a job and not know what I was doing. You know, it was important to me
right.
to actually get the knowledge. But you talk
that's,
about when
yeah.
I retired, when we moved to Savannah, Georgia, that's where I made Gulfstream. And I was offered, because I had an AMP,
uh-huh.
I was offered a job maybe 3-4 times if I wanted to work because
wow.
They could get mechanics, but they needed the AMPs because they needed someone to be able to sign things off, you know.
Cool. Hey, we have a caller if you want to take a call real quick.
Sure. Yeah.
Good evening, caller. What's your name?
Tom.
Where are you from? Your name is Tom.
Ohio.
Tom.
Who is it?
Tom McNeil.
Hi, Tom.
Hi, Bob. How are you doing?
I'm doing good. How's your arm?
Oh, it's stitched up and waiting.
Yeah.
I was listening to you guys talk about your experiences and how the cross training and everything you did. It was amazing coming out of active duty and then coming into the guard system. I have to tell you, I learned more at the guard in 1 year than I did from my active duty experience of 6 years there. But you think about all the trips we went on and everything, and all the people would gather around the airplane, and we do post-flight, pre-flights, and how fast we were turning them, and the experience, how everybody around you learned so much faster by being able to do and work on this stuff. You know, there was a lot of knowledge there every day.
Yep, I agree.
Totally agree.
They, that's why the Guard, you know, people make fun of it as raggedy-ass militia and stuff, but we could do with 18 airplanes have a third of the workforce than they do on active duty to do the same job, exactly what you're talking about, Tom.
Right. And, you know, it's you think about when that F-16 we had there clobbered in and went toward the fire department there.
Oh, yeah.
And
yeah.
Remember, they said, oh, my gosh, it's going to cost millions of dollars for us out of our budget to take this and get it fixed. And we all got together, and we were able to disassemble the aircraft, basically, for the mod team to come in and repair it. And you look at the millions
exactly.
we saved. And, you know, then we went out and did op checks and everything else to put that airplane back in the air. And if I remember right, we got by with less than half what it was going to cost from the factory doing it.
It's very possible, yeah. I remember I'm still friends with one of the guys on that mod team. But, again, like you say, they sent half a dozen people and, you know, pretty much we augmented them, you guys augmented them, and got the job done in a lot less time, a lot less money than, you know, projected. So.
Yeah. Well, we had it tore apart, and it was like 2 to 3 weeks. And then we
mm-hmm.
went on wait to come in, scheduled in to do it, you know.
Yeah.
It was funny you mentioned that A7 that Decker took in the duck lip on,
yeah.
on Panama. You remember we were short on engine people that trip too. And
yeah.
you and Jeff Roy and a couple others went out and they worked on it, made sure the ribs were okay. And, you know, and if you remember right, there was no parts available. We had to get a part from the factory for that.
Yeah.
And
yep.
Randy Karsten and I and a couple others, we pulled that engine and changed it around, slammed it back in. If we'd have had the parts for the duck lip, that would only have been down a couple of days.
Yep.
We'd have been ready to go again.
Yep. Basically, what we did is we had to make our own, you know, leading edge for it because we never really get what we needed. So we riveted it in, and to protect it, remember, I don't remember what the sealant was. Remember that sealant we used to mix up?
8802.
We must have put 10 pounds of that on the lip to make sure it can get the one-time flight home, you know.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah. But you got it done. You got it done, you know. And, you know, the Guard gets older airplanes, and they get newer. But part of the things with the Guard, why they get the older airplanes, is because active duty knows we can keep them flying longer. You know, the expertise, like you're talking about, you know, we can fly
yep.
things longer than they can on active duty.
Well, you think about the Guard gets the Air Force hand-me-downs, whatever they're
right.
not going to, they give to us. I read on Facebook last night that one of the units close by here is going to transition out of A-10s into F-16s again.
Fort Wayne.
Yep. The 127.
Really? Yeah, I heard that.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep. The transition.
I don't
again,
know what model.
I haven't heard what model yet. I don't know what block they're getting. But, you know, it's
yeah.
things like this. We go back and forth, and I don't think a lot of people realize that your manpower changes every time you change aircraft. So now
yeah.
all of a sudden, you think about over the years when we transferred airplanes or transitioned, you had people from different shops that had to go to training, and all of a sudden you had these people become something else totally different than what they were. But they were able to take their expertise and technology that they had already learned and apply it to the aircraft you were in. And once again, you end up with somebody that is multitaskable.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Yes, Tom. Actually, we went to Montana back in 2012. They went from F-16s, to C-130s, F-15s in a short period of time because their congressmen are weak. If you have weak congressmen, they'll do whatever they want to your unit. So imagine that. And they hated it. They couldn't take it anymore. It's like, we can't beat it. You can't switch like this all the time. Once you learn something, then you take it away. And it's all about your congressmen, how much power they have. John McCain was the king of taking aircraft from other units, from other states. So
well, you remember when we got rid of our Block 25s, we got Block 42s. I can remember that aircraft had not been on out of production all that long. We were amazed that we were getting that new of an aircraft.
Yeah, right. That was amazing.
Yeah, thank Marcy Kaptur for that.
Oh, okay. Cool.
Yeah, she was pushing it. Now, I just read, too, about a week or two ago that the F-16 is getting a whole bunch of new mods, including cockpit display, so on and so forth, from Block 40 on up. So,
oh, really?
If that's true, yes, Block 40 on up. So that means Toledo's in that mix now. Whether or not the money comes down for the Guard to get theirs done first or, you know, in line, I don't know. But it's Block 40 on up are the only ones getting these mega million-dollar mod coming up.
The funny thing, too, you mentioned that. I was watching something here the other night about the A-10 and how the A-10 had just recently been modified with all the newest and greatest bells and whistles and upgraded. And that's when I seen that they were getting rid of their A-10s in Fort Wayne. I kind of wondered, you know, maybe there's a reason why. Maybe it's, you know, the aircraft will be modified and upgraded too. But there's been many times the people in the Air Force have tried to get rid of the A-10, but it keeps proving itself. So
yes,
that's where Congress is stepping in, saying that they don't want to, you know, dump the A-10 because really, you know, in my mind, there's not much that can beat it for the job it does.
Right.
Absolutely.
You look what it does. It saved a lot of lives, saved a lot of missions. For as slow as it goes, it's still so accurate and has so much firepower in behind it that, you know, it's kind of hard to think about getting rid of it.
Exactly.
Yeah, that new radar is going to change everything. It's the game changer. They're putting in the new aircraft, the F-15EX and the new F-16s. And if they retrofit those, that's the smartest thing they can do, and nobody can touch them. That's the power of what they're putting in.
Well, the other day I was reading also and hearing that the Air Force now is developing some new fighters, or not fighters, excuse me, bombers that were designed strictly in a computer. And they haven't even flown one yet. And they said that's what they're going to start trying to do to save the tax dollars and the military budget some, is to put these into a computer simulation, because that's how good they've gotten with it, and be able to figure out what they want. If I heard and read right, I think there's two companies, and they're getting ready to buy one the way it sounds. They don't want to come out with it, but it sounds like it's going to be a bomber because it doesn't have any UHTs in it. Similar to the B-2.
Yeah. Right.
And back,
well,
I just
most people don't know what you're talking about, Tom. Can you explain what UHT is?
Well, the fighters have to be able to maneuver a lot faster, and without UHTs, you're not fighting. These are strictly similar to the B-1 type, where they're very slow.
They don't have the rear empennage with the
UHT is basically UHT is basically your horizontal stabilizer.
Right, and that's what they're saying is with these new models that they can put in the computer. And in fact, they were telling that they were using references from other aircraft, the way they flew and everything else, and inputting it into here and taking all the knowledge and everything that they had and put into this. And the way it sounds, they've come up with a really couple of good computer models. So fortunately for the Air Force and their budget and the military, if this can prove to be, we're going to be saving billions of dollars on testing of this stuff.
Yes, right. So, okay, here's what I see. The Air Force has their own research and development, but the bulk of this always comes from other Americans, like the contract, like Lockheed Martin, your Boeing, all these people are incredible, and they do this kind of work. And this is Americans working together, and the U.S. Air Force is using this, and I see this a lot. And this is it's all good, you know. Innovation does not lie in the military. Innovation lies in the public, in the defense contractors and things like that. And that's what I like to see. They have, okay, your best engineers are not going to work for the Air Force. They're going to go to these other companies, and this is a great thing. So we're using that and leveraging that, and I think that's not what a lot of countries have. So we get to see this technology, and it's the same thing in airlines and everything. The technology is incredible, but it all comes from people like that are serving our country in different ways. I just had to throw that in there. I saw the opportunity. I jumped in. Sorry about that.
No, that's right. It makes sense.
What they said was they wanted to get away from the normal production of these and the companies that do this every day, because they're looking at, you know, they know that there's other companies out there that are every bit as good as they are, but they just haven't been given a chance. Well, now with this, they're going to be able to give these companies a chance.
Yeah.
And it's going to do nothing but drive pricing down.
Exactly, yeah. They're not for bid. So, and in my mind, Lockheed Martin is the best, just saying.
I'll let you guys go. You have a good night.
Caller, thanks, Tom. I appreciate you calling.
Yeah.
Thank you. See you later. So that was interesting. Tom does a lot of research.
Yeah.
He does a lot of research.
He does,
he keeps up on this stuff. Yes. He's a heck of a guy. Good guy. So like you are.
I just talked to him a couple of weeks ago. He posted that he broke his arm, his wrist or something. That's why I was asking him how his arm was.
Yeah. He's been on the show a couple of times. Good guy.
Oh, good.
And he's got quite a past, his early Air Force career, but we won't talk about it here.
Exactly.
So this is interesting because I want to have Captain Wayne Smith on with the F-4 guy, with an F-15 or F-16 pilot at the same time, a modern person that's retired. He's not funny as anybody that's in right now. More people from Vietnam.
Gotcha.
So I'm going to do this, and I mean, I don't have any WW2, but I do admire the Vietnamese, Vietnam era veterans. So I think they had it worse in many ways when they got home. So fascinating how history goes and how things change. So we have 4 minutes left, as you can see on your clock, almost 5 minutes.
Okay.
Is there anything you want to talk about yourself, you want to bring up?
Not really. I'm trying to think what I haven't covered yet. The experience, good, bad, or indifferent, like you say, was an experience. It made you grow up faster, too, both over there and getting home. You know, you weren't just a kid out of high school anymore when you're over there doing it for real. And, you have to grow up fast. And it's all the services. I mean, the poor kids in the foxhole behind the trigger, you know, a year before that, they were at the prom or, you know, 6 months. and now they're laying in a mud hole somewhere. You know, we're doing airplanes to get them the missions to do whatever they had, whether it be a truck park or someone in caisson. You know, we do what we do, and makes you grow fast.
Yeah, it does. The home is the greatest place in the world when you go on a deployment like that. You're there for a long time.
Yeah.
There's nothing like
home. Yeah.
No place like home. And then you get treated like you did, and I think that's a shame. But still, home, it's hard to describe home when you've not been away from it.
Yeah, exactly.
So long to come home and
especially
see your family.
That long, like I say. I was gone 2 years, well, counting basic vet school. I was gone 2.5 years out of my 4. And, you know, so you learn to be an adult. Most people learn to be an adult faster. Some never grew up. And me included, you know, it was a good experience, even with the bad. When you look back at it now, I wouldn't have traded it for anything. You know, I see kids today, I'll be at the store and I have my hat on, it has the Vietnam, you know, ribbons on it and stuff. And kids, it could be, you know, 7 years old, 6, come up to me and say, thank you for your service and shake my hand.
Wow.
And that
just
makes me feel good. Yeah, it does. The people here in Tennessee are very patriotic when it comes to that, including the parents are teaching their kids to be that way. And, yeah, I can't tell you how many kids besides adults just come up to me and shook my hand.
Incredible.
So, you know,
that's great. That's great
so,
to recognize that. I guess you'll have me.
It makes you feel good. So I'm saying, you know, it was what it was back then, and it is what it is now, and they don't hold it against the troop anymore for what they did.
Right. It's beautiful.
Yeah, it is. It's
so we're
very
down to,
to be honest with you.
Yes, it is. Yes, sir. We're down to a little over a minute. So I appreciate you coming on the show. And
thank you.
Sharing your experiences. I like I said, the Vietnam vets. I appreciate everything they did for us. And you know, I had two uncles over there as well, and they came back safe when they were in the Army. And so, to me, it's like it's the war that nobody wants to remember. Seems like, and I'm so happy that things are turning around. So. Finally, people realize what you guys did. So, and it affects them. So, meanwhile, thank you for coming on. And tell your wife, Karen, I said hello. She was a workmate of mine as well at my time. And
will do.
You have a wonderful evening, sir.
Well, thank you for having me on. I hope I didn't ramble on too much.
No, you're fine. So I'm going to close the show. You can stay on if you want. So Ben, Robert Reinecker, retired as a chief, was in the Air Force beginning, Army Guard for a little bit, and then the Air National Guard. And he now lives in Tennessee. So we honor our veterans and keep wearing that hat. Everybody loves you. Everybody loves what you're doing, what you did. Thank you, everybody. We will be back next Wednesday with another show. Everybody take care. God bless America. You still there?
Thanks, Kev.
Okay. We're off the air.